In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about race in America, where we are and from where we have come. And our guest is Thomas Holt. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago and has published a book titled The Problem of Race in the 21st Century. It's published by the Harvard University Press, and in fact is based on a series of lectures that he gave. Very first line here of the book notes that in the early part of the last century, the African-American intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois observed that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Obviously, he thought that it was a serious issue in America, race. And the question so we begin with here as we talk with Thomas Holt is, now that we are entering into a new century, the 21st, is race still the prime problem that we have to deal with? Or has its nature, the way we think about race, has it changed? We'll try and explore the territory as we talk with Thomas Holt. And, of course, questions are welcome. Anyone listening is welcome to call and share their thoughts with us. All we ask is people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But anyone can call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Professor Holt, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Do you think that now that we are in a new century, the 21st century, that the problem of the color line is still the problem of the century?
Well, I might not put it as Du Bois put it, the problem of the color line, but certainly race is still a very critical problem, not only in this country, but in many other countries of the world, particularly the industrial democracies, the ones, especially the ones we often refer to or group together as the G7 nations. All of them are facing various problems, often in the form of immigration, but that is, the problem arises in the form of immigration, unwanted immigrants, but it is a problem of race. Mm-hmm. And it's in a new, I think, phase or form. And the thrust of my book is to try to think about, you know, those changes from the problem as Du Bois faced it at the beginning of the 20th century. Hmm.
Well, there, I think that you get right to the central issue. And it is, I think you're encouraging people to think about this question a little bit differently than we might ordinarily, and that is to think about tension around race as being something that is intimately connected with economics.
Absolutely.
And that certainly is seems very much to be what's been going on in Europe, as we see in increasing tension around issues like immigration, very much coupled with the increasing presence of the extreme right in European politics. That seems to be what it's about. It's about competing for scarce resources.
Well, it's about that, and that's certainly one point at which one has to begin, I think. Mm. But it cannot be reduced to that. I mean, that's part of the problem of our, both for scholars and I think in popular thought, ordinary folk, in trying to understand race, is that we often reduce it to either a problem of attitudes that people might have toward other people. And so we measure that by various polling and other devices, and we say the attitudes are improving, and yet the problem of race still remains. Or we think of it in terms of simply a matter of exploitation of labor. Now, the argument in my book is that it has always, of course, been at the core a problem of labor mobilization, or at least it developed around the problem of labor mobilization, beginning with the slave trade in the 16th century. That continues today. We see features of that with groups being racialized in the sense that we have Mexican, Thai, and other groups, Chinese and other groups, brought into this country, and we find them in sweatshops in conditions not unlike you know, in some respects, of what we felt we've left behind, what we feel is, you know, kind of anachronism of the past in terms of our exploitation of labor. But it's also more than that. And we in the way that race works its way into our consciousness, our discourse, and the way we think about things, the way we think about public policy, for example, and in our culture. And so it's that complexity that I'm trying to at least suggest, and to suggest some ways of thinking about, that is the primary driving agenda of this book.
Well, is it that you're suggesting that one of the functions of race is that it is an enabling factor that fosters or allows or underpins or justifies economic exploitation?
Absolutely. And very rarely do you find situations of economic exploitation, certainly in democratic societies or societies that espouse democratic values, the values that we're familiar with, to some extent the contradiction between those values or those ideals and the very real world exploitation that goes on is resolved or dealt with in some way by racial ideas, by racializing the groups that are in fact exploited. So, in other words, it's I guess in a simple way, one might say it's kind of blaming the victim, that you can, you know, it is some quality of the people who are victimized by this exploitation that justifies their treatment.
I'm interested in the first section in the book. You raise the issue of definition and talk about how, in fact, when you start talking about it, it's not such an easy thing to say what race is, and you encourage people also to think about race as something that is socially constructed, and in a sense we've made it up, because it seems that we must admit to ourselves that in fact there really aren't any significant differences between people, and it's something like skin color is really pretty minor, and yet at the same time we take physical differences that maybe otherwise wouldn't matter, and we seem to make them matter a lot. And this does get back to this issue, well, what is race, really?
Well, in that first section, I address something that many historians and other social scientists and other intellectuals have been discussing for some time, this idea of race as a social construction. And what's very evident is that despite the fact that, you know, that idea has been around for at least 20 years or so, at least in academic discourse, we still, in popular discourse, the way people talk about race generally, and to some extent even academics, we still fall back on a kind of biological definition, or biological idea that race somehow inheres in physical characteristics, that people are responding to physical characteristics. And the example that I use in that to try to at least get people to think a little differently about it is from my own family, where, like many families, I was born in the South, and like many families, one part of the family actually has, because of racial intermixture back in slavery, era of slavery, is very light complexion and has features that are would lead one to, at least most people, to mistake them for white. And yet they're defined as black. And they're defined as black, I argue, by a variety of mechanisms, legal, the administration of such things as birth certificates and marriage licenses, by mechanisms that are sometimes a matter of violently by segregation, which was had been the dominant racial regime for much of my early life and the life of my parents and grandparents. And so it is not anything physical per se that, you know, defines that particular part of my family as, you know, black, but rather a set of practice, social practices, and that and agreed upon fictions that, you know, that makes that, you know, a social fact, fact in quotation marks. Mm.
Well, I hope you don't think this question too much of a side road, but I guess I am moved to ask it because of the recent stories that we've been hearing about the Human Genome Project and the conclusion of the researchers that, as far as they can determine, genetic differences between individuals are so small, they're almost non-existent. So this says that, in fact, an Asian person and an African person and a European person and a Latin person, yeah, they may look different, but at the very fundamental level, there is essentially no difference. Does knowing that do anything to the way that we think about race?
Well, we've known that for some time, actually. this has been the certainly, I guess, probably certainly the post World War II and perhaps even before, science had. Most biological science had come to that conclusion. In fact, I think there was a United Nations report, UNESCO report, that many decades ago that drove home that point. I think then it was estimated, on the based on this kind of science and measurements that they had at the time, about 5% of the, you know, genetic endowment could be racially coded in some way or varied according to race. You know, that, again, the fact that that doesn't really change how we think about race, at least on a day-to-day basis, and how we talk about race, suggests the difficulty that we're up against. That science, so far, I don't see how this will, you know, change it, be more successful in changing popular opinion or ideas about race than the evidence that we've had for much of the 20th century, actually.
Perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Thomas Holt. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago and is the author of the book that we're talking about here, The Problem of Race in the 21st Century. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And questions certainly are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We were talking about the sort of argument that you're making, or the suggestion that people at least incorporate some thinking about economics with their thinking about race. And you have in the book some sections where you talk about work and the changing nature of work, and how that connects with how we think about race. And were there indeed differences? You look at, for example, a major benchmark being when industrial manufacturing began to embrace the concept of the assembly line. So that changed things significantly. Do you see significant differences in the way that we have thought about race if you look at, in a sense, the era before that and the era after, when we are more intensely industrialized?
Yeah, that's one of the, I guess, breakpoints in the or points of significant change from what I call one racial regime to another. Before the early 20th century, basically, and this is a kind of generalization that obviously I could pause to qualify in various ways, but basically, the racial regime, or the way race was thought about, organized, and practiced, racism, revolved around the recruitment of labor, either as slaves, and that was a major starting point to where our modern ideas about race begins, Or later in the 19th century, with the abolition of slavery in most, certainly most of the Americas, the recruitment of indentured labor, which would be Indian labor, Chinese labor. In each instance, or each of those instances, a common feature of the racial regime was the need for a docile, controllable labor force that's somehow separated from the rest of the society, has different claims on society, or lesser claims on the society than the people who benefit from that labor. That's a broad generalization, but roughly that characterizes that first period. With the introduction of more urban, industrialized economy, and not only the industrial economy, but the industrial economy as part of a larger political economy, that is, an economy in which the state takes a very active role, as develops over the period of the early 20th century, not only in this country but in other countries as well, certain other countries as well. One finds a different kind of labor, or rather, I'm sorry, racial regime developing. One in which you no longer are controlling people on, you know, plantations, whether as slaves or indentured labor, but they are being pulled into wage labor occupations and living by and large in cities. And with that comes a set in motion a number of other changes in terms of culture, in terms of technology. So one of the points I make in that, in talking about that, is the growth of media, for example, more of a modern form that we are familiar with, movies, radio, eventually television. And this also has an impact on how we think about race, and also how groups resist, that is, groups that have been racialized or that are subject to racial victimization, resist the racial regime. So, for example, something like, let's say, programs like, movies like Birth of a Nation, which becomes the focus of contestation about how the image of blacks and how the history of race relations is portrayed, which has policy consequences, you know, in terms of as well. Mm-hmm. That becomes a focus of contestation in a way that would not have been relevant or possible in the previous 100 or so years. And there are other examples of that sort. So it's not simply that economy has changed. That's crucial and fundamental, but that a lot of other things change in tandem with that or in relation to that. And it changes the ground, so to speak, on which issues of race are fought out.
Well, carrying that forward then, now we seem to be in the midst of yet another change in the economy, a change in the nature of work. Certainly popular culture images in popular culture continue to change, and specifically images of African Americans and other people of color in popular culture continue to change. Are we in the midst of another period of change? And if the answer is yes, then where are we now?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. Certainly we are, and a wide range of analysts in various sectors or professions recognize this, in a period of significant economic change. What's often referred to as globalization, and the power of people with resources, I mean with capital, the way the economy functions in relation to the nation state. I mean, we're familiar with this in terms of the outsourcing, for example, of production, which is, you know, an issue that came up, I guess, in the 70s, and is now even more crucial. We are familiar with it in, perhaps a little less familiar with it in connection with something I mentioned earlier, the new recruitment of labor, where we bring in, or we find instances of illegal labor in sweatshop conditions, something that we thought we'd left behind earlier in this century, and certainly maybe in the last century, that is not the 19th century, and yet we're finding that recurring, and often, ironically, in industries that are making goods for a luxury, you know, consumer market. So all of these are, and a number of other developments are changing the nature of our economy, how it functions, and our politics, you know, our politics, and you know, issues as come up recently with the WTO, and issues are being fought out not simply within nation states, but on international venues, on an international scale. And so that, all of that, I'm arguing, will have as significant an impact on how we think about race, where we recognize, where we see race having an impact on our lives, as did the change at the beginning of the 20th century.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. We'll start with someone in Iowa, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I've read a little on labor history, and it involved the race issue, and it's really troubling. And it just seems that the power interests in the country find it, you know, not difficult to use race against race. Just specifically, was like the miners in the late 19th century, they striking in Colorado, and they would use the black cavalry to break the strikes and stuff like that. And well, just to move on, I've just got a question on how you feel about maybe a complete discussion on the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, you know, and what that would do for citizenship, you know, to have a thorough discussion on what we need to base our citizenship on, like income standards and health standards and housing standards, and you know, if a individual needs a stipend, you know, enough of a stipend to maybe take the family to a movie or to get transportation down to the library, you know, just mundane things like that that people take for granted, you know, most people do, and and how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would help in that regard.
Well, I'm not certain to the extent to which the Declaration of Rights itself, it's a very important document and an important institution. As you know, it is encountered difficulties at times in finding support among the member nations, including this nation, on precisely these kinds of social economic issues, as opposed to, you know, its intervention in various conflicts. I think your question, though, is part of a larger problem, problematic, of and an example of the kinds of changes that I'm suggesting are occurring that reframe our the way we think about racial issues. If one looks at the issues like globalization, of both in terms of the outsourcing of production, of the sort of free movement of capital, and the recruitment of labor, the kinds of things I've just been talking about. Traditionally, labor unions, civil rights organizations, various social movements, their addressee, if you will, the place that they could appeal, what they would mobilize around would be the nation state. I mean, that is Washington or Paris or London or Berlin or whatever the case may be. That is, they would look for national laws, national regulations. But we are in an era in which even if where there are national laws and regulations, they have been weakened in relation to these global forces. And so I think we have to rethink. So something like the United Nations and something like the Declaration of Rights or some new international addressee may, in the course of the 21st century, be necessary to remedy the kinds of problems that we would have raised through our voting in national elections or our appeals or petitions to national governments in the past centuries.
We're just a bit past the midpoint here, and I have other callers who will get right to, but I do think I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Thomas Holt. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago. And if you'd like to read more of his thoughts on this particular subject, you can look for the book, The Problem of Race in the 21st Century, published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Back here locally for a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm just wondering, forgive me, I may be mistaken, but it seems like the word I haven't heard in this conversation so far is class. And that thinking about British history, where they had a tendency to class themselves and make physical, minute distinctions that we wouldn't even consider to separate people, and how different Asian cultures, which at least in the United States, I think we have mostly a hard time telling the difference between a Korean person and a Chinese person, yet they class themselves. We seem to have this need to class ourselves, and race, especially in the United States, is kind of just a lazy way to do that. So what do you think about the idea that really class, as you've been talking about with the economic issues, is really at the core of this, is really the heart of this, not race?
Well, that, of course, has been much debated, the idea of race versus class, as if they were a dichotomy. I think, in my own argument, the race has in many ways some of the features of class. I mean, I'm talking about groups who are labor or workers who are mobilized with a through the means of a racial ideology or a process by which they are made into a race. So the distinction or the sharp line is not as vivid in this case. On the other hand, I think you cannot simply reduce race to class. I mean, there are ways in which, obviously, race operates, is a part of our imaginary, a part of our, as I say, our discourse, our conversation, of the way we think, that class, you know, is not. It is true that in some historical situations, class could be used practically as a synonym, in the sense that we normally think of class as something that one can work one's way out of, but race is, you know, the leopard never changes its spots.
Right.
So, you know, it's in many ways when we invoke race, we are, as I mentioned earlier, still it has a taint of biology to it, even when we use it in really as a cultural idiom or...
Right. Well, I want to bring it up because I think we all like to think in this country that we have a classless society. I'm of the opinion that that is very untrue, and I think that word class, should be in all discussions. like this. So I'm enjoying it a lot. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on to another caller here. This is Crete, and it's line 2. Hello.
Yes, I wonder what the good professor thinks of this revised idea of 40 acres and a mule that was talked about 1865, 66 by men like Howard. It is the Tillman thesis that black Americans should be given compensation, as were the Japanese recently, I think at $20,000 a head. I personally think it's nonsense, but I just wonder what the good professor thinks.
Am I still there?
Yes, yes.
I have some, I can understand where the argument for reparations or compensation comes from. I have some sympathy with its the motives behind it, especially in an era in which that has become the sort of order of the day. Many groups and many places have appealed for and have been successful in getting reparations for past crimes. I don't think it's very practical or effective in this instance. That is, when one defines reparations as the payment to individuals or any given cohort or class of individuals of X amount of dollars. One, the amount of dollars would probably be fairly insignificant, maybe even less than George Bush's tax cut. And the real issue is reparations, perhaps, in the sense of rectifying current conditions for a broad for society more broadly. That is, that social policies with respect to education, employment, etc., would be addressed, and monies and effort put into that, as opposed to reparations for individuals. I mean, it's sort of an American tendency to individualize, you know, what is in fact more broadly a broad social problem.
Professor Holt, you know, I'm amazed by one thing. There's been unlimited number of books written on race since about 1870, and almost none of them, or a very small percentage of them, have in any way dealt with the Native American race issue. They've always talked about the Chinese, which is about less than 1% population in California. They've talked about the Greeks in Omaha being rioted in 1905. They've talked about the Puerto Ricans and the Mexicans and the Chicanos and the Cubans and the blacks. But as far as, I don't know about your index, I would guess that there'd be very little in your book on the Native American, but I feel somewhat, not as a Native American, but as a good American citizen, that in this question of race, the most obvious misinterpretation and misstep has been the fact that the Native American has almost been completely left out of that scholarly research.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I do actually talk a bit about Native Americans, but not probably in a very small way toward the end of the book, but and more about the symbolism around Native Americans. I think a part of it, I think you're right. I mean, actually, I teach courses in which I do include a whole section on Native Americans along with Asian Americans, Black Americans, and so forth, Latinos. But in much of the literature, I suspect that's reflecting the fact that the Native American experience is in some ways divergent from that of these other groups. Most of these other groups who are racialized in America came or were mobilized or recruited as labor. For the most part, Native Americans have not, although they are, and some recent studies are showing that in the 1930s and other periods, they have been also mobilized as labor in certain parts of the country. But if you're talking about Chinese labor, you're talking about Mexican Americans coming to this country, Puerto Ricans coming to the East Coast, and obviously Black Americans. That is a common thread running through. It makes it comparable in some respects. Native Americans, I think, are very interesting in terms of national policy and how the groups were thought about, and also in terms of what I would call the sort of racial iconography of this country. But they were peoples whose lands were, of course, expropriated, but who are not, by and large, a major part of a racialized labor force in this country.
Can I get one more question in?
Sure.
I knew John Hope Franklin. I know John Hope Franklin. And for many years, the excellent historian, was at the University of Chicago. And I, at that time, he was the only Afro-American in the history department at the University of Chicago. He was the token Uncle Tom for many of us, because there were many qualified blacks who were not there and should have been there probably. I would just like to know, that was 40 years ago, 30 years ago. How many black professors of history, Mr. Holt, are there today?
At the University of Chicago?
That's correct.
There are two.
Yeah, there's about one more than 40 years ago. So I think that this is an example of what you're talking about at home base, okay? If you can't get more than two black historians at the University of Chicago, you've made your point. Period.
Well, I should say that, you know, they are, at least since I've been here, there's been a significant recruitment of black professors in other fields in the social sciences. So that's, and since we all, in some, to some degree, work together, share students and so forth, that, you know, the progress should be measured in those terms and not simply by this department.
I want to return to an issue that the first caller raised, and he made the observation that in the past race has been used as a way of dividing workers and preventing them from organizing. I think, though, also in the book you say that you think perhaps the civil rights movement has missed an opportunity to make alliances with labor.
Yeah, the what I was suggesting there, and this is reflecting in particular some work that's been done recently on social movements in Brazil and in South Africa, the movement against apartheid, in which alliances between a what I might call a social movement and labor was a key to the success of those movements. In the United States, we've faced a situation, of course, in which labor had, as the caller suggested, the particular way in which labor developed, the labor movement developed in the United States, excluded African Americans, as well as other racialized groups, for that matter, from the ranks of labor for a very long time, eventually did recruit African Americans into the labor movement with the rise of the CIO in the late 30s and during the 40s. And then that hopeful change was short-circuited by, in particular, the McCarthy-era attack on labor, or at least on leftists in labor, which resulted actually in black workers or blacks who are part of the union movement losing, in many cases, some of their strongest allies. And so you had a situation by the 1950s where labor essentially was, with some exceptions, was either indifferent to, hostile to, antagonistic to many of the aspirations of blacks, especially economic aspirations in terms of employment and economic progress. And so the kind of broad-based movement that might have resulted that one sees in other parts of the world did not, in fact, develop with the civil rights movement. So it's, although contrary to what the ideas many people have, often characterized the civil rights movement, it was, you know, very much concerned with employment and economic issues. After all, the March on Washington in 1963 was for jobs and freedom, but nonetheless, and had labor representatives as part of that coalition. In terms of the broad labor movement, and especially at the rank and file level, that coalition never really quite gelled, and of course that becomes very evident in the late 60s and 70s when often some of the fiercest antagonists for against blacks or against minorities were workers themselves and the people in the labor movement themselves. So contests around employment opportunities, especially in the construction industry. You may have remember images of people lying in front of bulldozers and things like that. And, of course, eventually the move of a significant part of the working class into a coalition with the Reagan era Republicans. So that's what I was suggesting. It's that in some ways the history in the United States in that regard has been well somewhat exceptional. I mean, not entirely exceptional, but it has its own particular course of development that has, in effect, weakened a social movement at a very critical juncture.
Hmm. Just for the, we have about 5 minutes left or so. I'm interested in your observations about race and how it is reflected in popular culture. And I guess I also I would include the news media. And it's interesting that all along, I think people have been concerned, African Americans have been concerned about the way they have been portrayed in media. So going back before there was, in fact, broadcast media, there was that concern. And it's interesting now to see the extremes that are portrayed, both in terms of people who have done quite well and are influential figures and people who are still increasingly disadvantaged. And sometimes I think the concern is that there's nothing in between. In what ways do you think the popular culture either continues to perpetrate the way that we perpetuate the way that we think about race, or may indeed have changed the way that we think about race?
I think both are true. I guess I have some hesitation. It's a question that I raise in this book. I'm not yet certain how to answer it in terms of of what's happening now and what we can expect in the future. It is very clear that at the beginning of the 20th century, was incidents like the Birth of a Nation protest organized by the NAACP against Birth of a Nation, with the images of sports figures like Jack Johnson at the beginning of the century, of Joe Louis in mid-century, and most recently Michael Jordan, as well as other sports celebrities. That image has been very, very critical in the formulation of people's racial ideas. And what I argue in the book is that it's also clear how that imaginary, if you will, or that image, those images have been linked to the economy via consumption, via advertising. I mean, one of the places that we see the image of blacks most frequently today, as contrast, say, to my childhood, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, is in commercials. That a kind of, not only in terms of black figures being spokesmen for products, and not only sports products, as was the case some years ago, anymore. And how this shapes our ideas about race is, I think, is an empirical question that I think needs to be thought about and investigated more. It was a question or an issue that certainly was recognized, as I say, very early on by organizations like the NAACP and others. It has continued to have some resonance and force as illustrated most recently by the NAACP's protest about the representation of blacks on primetime television programs. That's as far as I can go on that. It's just to point to it as an area that we need to take into account as we talk about how race is reproduced and perpetuated.
Yeah.
And that's also what I meant when I said earlier that it cannot be, while economics is at the core of it, it cannot be reduced to an issue only of economics, of jobs, and so forth.
Hmm. We have come to the end of our time for this hour of our program, and my apologies, we have a couple of callers we cannot take. But indeed, if you're interested in reading some more of the thoughts of our guests on the subject, you can look for the book, The Problem of Race in the 21st Century. It is a series of essays based on a series of lectures that he delivered at Harvard University, and the book is indeed published by Harvard University Press. Our guest, Thomas Holt, professor of history at University of Chicago. Professor Holt, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.